You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Colin Westerbeck. He's a photographer, a curator, and a historian. Colin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about what you're doing. There's a number of aspects that I'd like to talk about, but what are you working on at the moment? What are you consumed with?
I just finished up a project. I published last November a book on Chuck Close's photography and was the co-curator of an exhibition that's now up at the Parrish Museum, opened last month. And I'm in the middle of working on an exhibition that I proposed to the dealer Howard Greenberg in Manhattan, an exhibition called The Democracy of Imagery that's drawn from his quite vast stock and trade of photographs. He's really a dealer who has really a museum quality inventory that's been built up over many years. And so this exhibition is turning out to be quite fascinating. And Steidl, the publisher Steidl, is going to do a book in connection with the exhibition. And that should probably open and the book come out next spring. And then at some point next year, I'm hoping as well, a new third edition of Bystander, A History of Street Photography, the book I wrote with Joel Meyerowitz, originally published in 1994, then in paperback with a new added section in 2001, and now yet a newer version of it that will have a fifth section bringing up to date the history of that particular genre. So that, and it looks like I may be teaching a graduate seminar at UCLA again next year. I haven't done that for a few years, but I've been invited to propose one. So I'm staying pretty busy.
You know, it's interesting with photography books on photography and the history. I mean, am I wrong, or does photography seem to often get more like an extension of its history and importance in books as opposed to painting? Or other mediums. Photography looks so beautiful in books. I mean, I love photography books. They're beautiful books. Doesn't that do something for the medium that in a way other mediums don't have?
Yes. In the last 20 years or 25 years, photography, which despite the fact that after many years of campaigning on the part of photographers to have it accepted as an art form, there were photography departments in museums, as you are aware, I think. For almost 20 years, I worked in one of those museums myself as a curator, the Art Institute of Chicago. But still, it was photography functioned under a kind of doctrine of separate but equal. It was acknowledged, but it wasn't considered, it was never accepted as an art form in its own right in the way that painting is. And it remained in what a former curator at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art here used to call the photo ghetto. But then, partly because of postmodernism and the way that people who came in from outside the medium began talking about it and its relationship to both popular culture and the culture at large, photography began to be not only acknowledged, but, you know, it began to be represented by the kind of galleries that represented mainstream contemporary painting. It began to be included in exhibitions that were really about the whole history of art rather than photography as a separate issue. And as a result, it's been a kind of growth market for going on 20 years now and receives a lot of attention. The Hammer Museum here in LA, for instance, is just in about a week or so, is opening an exhibition called Picture Perfect that is devoted completely to new developments in photography and will be in their main galleries. So yes, their photography has received a lot of attention, and there are new monographs coming out all the time, and it's still a field that's being explored in a way that older media don't need to be anymore.
That's true. And do you think photography has come out of the ghetto, so to speak, as you were, you know, saying someone called it was before? Has it really arrived?
Yes. Yeah, it has, because, I mean, ultimately, the indicator of status in the art world, the only one that's really reliable and universal, is money. And photographs are as large as paintings now, and they in many instances attract painting prizes, and certainly Sotheby's and the other prominent auction houses, as well as prominent dealers, do exhibitions of photography on a level and with a frequency that they just didn't in more distant decades. And it's really a sign of the that collectors collect it, that these prizes are paid for it, and that it gets included increasingly in collections, both private and public, that used to be devoted to painting and thought of photography as second rate. Just not true anymore.
Which is really great news for photography, right? I mean, for whatever everybody says about the art world, good and bad, or the market, that's good news for photographers and, in a sense, the history of photography.
Well, what's interesting now is, I have taught before a graduate seminar in the UCLA's, the University of California at Los Angeles, in their MFA program. A course that I'm hoping to do maybe at the end of next year with them is one that will explore the way in which historically photography, and a lot of photography that is now very much accepted as an art form and is included in major museum collections, including the art institutes where I worked, especially 19th, early 20th century photography, was often done officially for another purpose. It was either a part of an archive, or it was photojournalism, or it had some function that wasn't just to be a photograph. It was to convey news or to document exhaustively geography or whatever.
Right.
And one of the reasons that I'm walking my students through this idea, this is going to be a course that I'm going to call The Field of Photography, looking at photography and archives, photography and archaeology, photography in various other guises, is because the students that I'll be working with are people getting an MFA in photography at a very good school, a school that's produced a lot of prominent photographers in recent decades. And they'll expect to make a living out of, you know, teaching and creating and selling in galleries and showing in museums their photography. Well, this is, you know, this is a development of the last maybe 30 years at the most.
That they could even, you mean, have that hope or have that.
Well, right, that you could make a living at it, that it was a vocation and indeed a profession to be an art photographer. Then that you could train for that and look forward to it, hope to conduct it as a career. Photographers in the past have often had to do something else. They had a day job or they made photographs for another purpose. But from the beginning, the most talented photographers, whether they thought of themselves as or aspired to be artists or not, you know, they had their own idea of how to make a picture, even if they're essential assignment was to, you know, to make it purely as a document.
Right.
And so certain pictures emerge from that history as the core of what is now considered the history of the art of photography. Well, I was just going to say that the classic case of this was Eugène Auger, a documentary photographer in Paris who worked freelance. He was a failed actor. He took up photography to make a living. He had a little atelier with the sign outside that said documents for artists, photographing old Paris. But indeed, he was an absolute genius of the camera, and his archives were rescued by an American photographer, Bernice Abbott, when he died in 1929. And ultimately, the Museum of Modern Art gave him, I think it was four exhibitions, each with a separate catalog.
Amazing. Yeah, his work is just gorgeous. I remember that story of Bernice Abbott. It was something like 50,000 mm-hmm. negatives or something. I don't know, extraordinary. Those were all like a large format glass plates,
yes.
Weren't they?
Right. And there was a fair amount of a number of vintage prints as well that came with it. But yes, some of them were reprinted in a manner consistent with the way Atje himself printed the the work. And when Bernice Abbott befriended him, and the other person who befriended him was Man Ray. Man Ray was really the guy who discovered him, because Man Ray, as a young artist, lived on the Rue Campagne Premier, near where Adjaye was, and he saw this sign, and he went in. He was interested in photography himself, as were the surrealists at times when other art forms were disdainful of photography. And he went in and met Adjaye, and Adjaye would tell Man Ray and Bernice Abbott, when they would ask him about his work, he would say, basically, well, people don't know what to photograph, by which he meant they don't know how to photograph. It took me years to learn this, and I understand something about it that, quote unquote, people don't.
I like that. Yeah, very interesting, amazing photographer. And of course, Bernice Abbott is, I think is a fantastic photographer as well.
Mm-hmm. She is.
She did some beautiful work. So let's go back a little bit to how you got involved in the arts and curating and everything. Did you grow up in an arts or culturally rich environment?
I went to a private school where interest in the arts was encouraged, and would go to museums. When I was a teenager, a favorite place for me to take a date was on a Saturday afternoon, was to a museum, a sort of cultural snow job to try and make some headway with a girl.
Right.
So it got me interested in art, and I also had friends. My parents didn't collect art, but the parents of a good friend of mine did, who I was in school with. And they had a little kind of a salon Friday evenings. People could drop in for cocktails and that kind of thing. And they had a house with a lot of very interesting painting in it. So that got me interested in the arts. But then I went to graduate school. I got a PhD in English at Columbia University. And by the time I'd finished the doctoral degree, I realized that in a way I should have stopped with the master's essay, because the level of factual documentation and referencing, exhaustive referencing that a dissertation and the kind of publishing that academic writing is attached to, it didn't interest me. I had always liked writing, and I began writing movie reviews partly just for recreation, because I liked writing and I wasn't doing that kind anymore as a graduate student. And I wound up writing a movie column for Commonweal magazine. Catholic Weekly came out of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement, and this was in the late 60s and early 70s. It was a fabulous place to work. The Berrigan brothers, very strong in art, Jesuits, very strong in the art, in the anti-war movement, were writing for the magazine and being talked about in the magazine. But what I really loved about it was a newsprint weekly. So I wrote 48 movie reviews a year for them, and I loved it. And I realized that kind of writing was what I wanted to do. And that led me eventually into writing about photography as well, when I met the photographer Joel Meyerowitz. The other thing about New York in the 70s. The 70s was one of the worst decades in New York history. The city was bankrupt. There was crime in the streets, graffiti everywhere. It was wonderful to live in New York then. You lived in a rent-controlled apartment on the Upper West Side, and it was a little village. If there was somebody you needed to know, you met them through an acquaintance. A painter I knew who lived on 100th and Riverside, I lived on 103rd and Riverside, introduced me to Joel Meyerowitz, who lived on 100th and West End Avenue. And that got me really interested. When I first met Joel Meyerowitz, he gave me a copy of Robert Frank's book, The Americans. And I sat down to look at it while Joel was in his darkroom the afternoon I first came to meet him. And by the time he came out of the darkroom, I was jumping up and down. I said, this is a paper movie. It's the most incredible movie I've ever seen. And from then on, he and I talked about doing a history of street photography, and that, working on that, and then publishing pieces on photography under three different editors for Art Forum in the 70s and early 80s, led me by pure serendipity to work in a museum. I came to Chicago at the last minute to fill in for someone who was teaching the history of photography at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. And this person, I don't know, he had problems or something. But anyway, he bailed on them, you know, like in August. And they didn't have anybody to teach the course in September. And somebody I knew recommended me to them as a kind of off chance. And I said, yeah, because I needed a job. So I came to Chicago. And within a couple of years, I was then offered a curatorship in the museum, which astounded me. I mean, that wouldn't happen. If you didn't have a PhD from Yale in art history, you would never get a job like that today. But I was lucky.
Right.
It took me a long time to figure out what curators do. I had no idea. I'd never taken an art history course in my life.
But you figured it out. I mean, you...
I did eventually, yes.
So I wasn't thinking of asking you about this, but you must have weighed in, or know if you've done writing on this, but Vivian Maier and that whole cast of street photography. What do you think about that story and her work?
I think it's really interesting. Yeah, John Maloof, the guy who found the material and has brought it to everybody's attention, and indeed it's received an enormous amount of attention. He came and talked to Joel and me, and then especially he really stuck with Joel, and Joel is in the movie that was made about him and so forth and so on, Joel Meyerowitz. So we knew about this from early on, and it was a genuine discovery. What has happened to it since, I wouldn't say that I regret it or disapprove of it, but the emphasis has been much more on her as a personality, you know, this rather strange, very reclusive, in some ways quite eccentric woman, rather than the photographs have been used as a kind of insight in a way that's really not about whether she's a genius of photography or not, but more about the limitations of her personality and the kind of bizarreness of her personality in a lot of ways. And that interests me less than the question of what really is the value of this photography and what does the photography tell us about her as a talent rather than as an eccentric.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What is the what do you feel the value of the photography is
in terms of her case?
Yeah, and really separating her story out in the context of history and the contribution that she's made or not.
Well, again, it's not that her eccentricities and the rest of her life besides being a photographer. Part of the problem is that we really don't know a hell of a lot about her life as a photographer. You know, she had these things processed at the drugstore for the most part. She never had a dark room, and I don't think really understood a lot about how to use one. And most of the prints that have come to light now are ones that are restrikes that this guy John Maloof has trained himself to do and now has a staff of people doing it. And they're what's feeding the market in her work. But again, I'm more interested in the question of whether she is, or what sense she is, perhaps she's a kind of Aceh in a way, this eccentric person who took up photography as a kind of sideline or because another career didn't work out or had to support herself doing something else, and turned out to have a considerable impact with that stuff. Well, what interests me more than the kind of general human interest story that it's turned into in a lot of the press coverage and a lot of the attention paid to it is the question of, really what is the essential quality of this photography and how do we understand from the photography who this woman was and how she made it. Some of that is going to be purely speculative. Again, there's no written record. There's not even anywhere near as much record as there was of Aceh's material. Because at least Aceh was selling work and placing work in again, historical archives, places like the Bibliothèque Nationale and so forth in his lifetime. It was known to a lot of people as a documentarian. And so there is some tracking on him of a kind that there's not on Vivian Maier because she was dead. You know, it was
But with Vivian, it's still a bit of curating. It's more a curatorial project. I mean, wasn't Winogrand also like that, right? This kind of curatorial project.
Right. Right.
So many negatives, and who knows which one she really liked or not. Right.
There are not a lot of prints from, I think there's some prints, I don't really know how many, but basically it's been a reprinting process. And again, it's because she had died intestate, and there was a, she had this stuff in a storage locker, and it got turned out and was sold in a, you know, in an auction, you know, one of these sort of yard sale type auctions.
Right. I read this story, and I remember I contributed to that Kickstarter project at the time. I thought it was remarkable, and I still, as much as I've read the other coverage, her work, I find, I can't say her work in general, but there's so many images out there, and I've seen work that seems extraordinary to me. You know, it seems not only beautiful, but also has kind of this unique quality. It is this woman's gaze, who she is in this city and how she is, you know, to me, observing and connecting with everybody, which is has a poetry to it of some kind. I don't know. I'm very moved by her work. I'm really impressed, you know.
Yeah. No, I agree. As I say, it's more the kind of press attention that it's gotten than that I don't think that she's worth thinking about. I would like to see a little more focused thinking about her work. But yeah, no, I mean, she definitely is part of this tradition of street photography that Joel Marowitz and I have been working on now. As I say, going through what is, we hope by the end of next year, is going to be a third edition of the book. We're working with a publisher now on that. So sure, yes, Vivian Meyer fits into that genre. That's one reason that Joel winds up in the film and is kind of approached as an expert. And again, but his voice speaking to the photography is not the mainstream of the kind of attention that she's gotten as a personality. Anyway.
And just to bring, it's come right up to the present. So it was great talking to you, and especially about the history of photography and how photography is in this really fortunate place right now, in some respects, in terms of freedom of the medium and the way it's accepted. Do you feel that there's this notion of making huge prints is still okay? I mean, does that strike you as well? I guess I'm thinking of, I interviewed Dwayne Michaels a while ago, and everybody has a different point of view, but he was talking about photography in the market, and of course he tends to work in a very intimate scale, and he said, I never trust a photograph I can't fit in my living room.
And
he was commenting on what he thought was a bit crass, this kind of huge print. What was that about? What do you think of that? Is that, what's your take on, I guess, from I mean, I'm saying, I guess that's what he was referencing, you know.
It is. He's actually written a book, a very witty book, disdaining, you know, the way in which the money in the art market is sort of warping and distorting, in his view, the art of photography.
Who did? I'm sorry. Dwayne Michaels wrote a book about that?
Yeah.
I saw that one.
It's a book called Photo Follies: How Photography Lost Its Virginity on the Way to the Bank.
Huh.
Published it about, I don't know, within the last year and a half, I think. It's an amusing book, but again, the change that's taking place now, and what's really making possible these enormous prints is digital technology. And digital technology is, you know, we're at the kind of watershed that photography crossed when it went from hand-prepared plates and view cameras to smaller cameras like first the Kodak Brownie, but then the Leica 35mm camera and so forth. That kind of watershed, there's more continuity even in that extraordinary change in the history and nature of photography. But now we're crossing an even greater watershed into the digital era. That's digital, you know, scanning is what's making possible these kinds of enormous prints. One of the things that's interesting about it is that there's a very interesting show right now at the Getty Museum on photo process, and it's about a whole group of younger, mostly younger artists who are all buying out-of-date film because, you know, there's a lot of film that's not being manufactured anymore. This Chuck Close project I worked on, Chuck Close has used Polaroid 2024 film for most of his career, and as at the end of 2014, he ran out of the last stock he had of it. It doesn't exist anymore. So what's happening is that there's a whole group of very interesting, very currently hot photographers who are in many cases using and indeed abusing, calling attention to the frailty of past processes which they're using, but at the same time using scanning to make very large-scale prints and scanning the idea of the computer as a kind of portable darkroom and as a portable studio that you can carry with you to both look back at the history of photography and the watershed we're crossing and marking that watershed with a kind of monument of deteriorated prints in a way, at the same time that they're also stepping into the future with this. In a funny way, it reminds me, it's not exact an exact analogy, but, you know, in the 18th century, I believe it was, when mechanical frames came in, hand weavers, there were a group of them called themselves frame breakers, who would try to smash these new looms because they were stealing work from them. Well, this is a little different, but this time, photographers who really totally rely on digital technology to create their work are nevertheless sort of reacting against the current moment by going back and showing us the inherent messiness, the inherent chemical strangeness of the history of photography that is now, for all intents and purposes, over.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting.
John Chiara, let me just mention a name or two. John Chiara, Allison Rossiter, Matthew Brand. These are all relatively young people, at least Brand and Chiara, who have been, you know, doing this in just the last few years.
Hmm. Yeah, that's always true. That is all so new, isn't it? It's still such in its infancy, this kind of digital technology. Now all that is incorporated into the scale and scope of photography.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's this kind of, you know, a scanned negative. If you have a 4x5 or 8x10 negative and you scan it, you can make a print the size of a wall of a building if you want to.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I guess the first prints that I saw that were large were, and I guess this was pre-digital, I think, was Cindy Sherman's pictures at the Whitney, those enormous prints, which mm-hmm. I thought were gorgeous and incredible. I mean, the color and everything, but I think those mm-hmm. were, that must have been pre-digital. Right, that was 90s.
Yeah, I don't know at what point she began doing this. Yeah, I mean, yes, the market for large prints, what fueled it originally, and indeed the artists who were successful enough to be able in the age when you still had to process these prints in a way that wasn't just digital, you know, dry technology, was that artists who were sufficiently successful could afford that and do it. And part of what fueled it, again, was the market, but also the museum, because the point was photography was becoming as important as painting. In fact, in some ways, more important. It was thought of as a more inventive, more lively medium in certain ways. But in order to take advantage of that, and especially to get the prices up, you had to produce something the size of a painting.
Right. And it has, and photography has, and it is arguably successfully competing with painting in the market, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, no, it does.
Colin, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's really it's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.